This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Carol Van Dam, and here's what's coming up.
I, for one, have a special needs son. And when there's medication that's needed, if things need to happen and our batteries are running out, there's nothing we can do. Then you've got to scramble around trying to get decent care.
That's South African resident Denise Govender, who's already struggling to cope with the country's electricity shortages, which appears to be getting worse. Also, journalists in Cameroon protest after a colleague was killed and a member of Tunisia's security services kills four and injures others. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. The president of the Democratic Republic of Congo has accused East African forces deployed to fight rebels in his country of working with the enemy. Félix Tshisekedi made the remarks Tuesday during a visit to Botswana, where he welcomed the planned deployment of Southern African forces as a replacement. Mukhtwandisi Dube reports from Gaborone, Botswana.
Addressing journalists in Gaborone, Tshisekedi, who spoke through an interpreter, said there were problems within the East African Community Regional Force deployed to fight the M23 rebels in the east of DRC.
We are going to evaluate the situation because there are problems of functioning problem in this with this regional force. The first reason that pushes us to ask ourselves questions is the role of that was assigned to this regional force, which is not fulfilled today in certain regions. There is a cohabitation that we have noticed between the contingents of the regional forces of Eastern Africa and also the terrorists of M23, which was not the plan.
The DRC president did not specify how the East African forces are working with the rebels, but said his government has had to re-evaluate the operations in the east.
We had to stop working together with the forces of Democratic Republic of Congo so that we can get peace. It means we have a ceasefire, the retreat. But unfortunately, today we notice that there are forces that are tolerating that. And we also have some officers, either from the countries of these contingencies, where the military officers of those countries, when reaching the in DRC, they say they are not coming to fight M23.
Came after the commander of the East African forces, Kenyan General Jeff Nyaga, abruptly quit the DRC mission at the end of April.
He's talking about threats, but he has never told us anything about those threats. Why did he not tell us about the threats? He alone knows. And when he decides to leave the Democratic Republic of Congo, Kenya directly designs or sends another commander of the force without consultations, as if that force only belonged to Kenya. So there must be a problem. So we need to talk about it.
Tshisekedi says the planned deployment of Southern African Community Development SADC troops is welcome, particularly at a time when the 12th duty of some East Africa regional forces is coming to an end. Botswana's President Mokgweetsi Masisi, speaking during a state banquet organized for Tshisekedi Tuesday night, said there is a need to find a solution to challenges in the Eastern DRC.
Let us not make a mistake. The agents of instability are hard at work to frustrate genuine efforts aimed at finding a lasting solution to the problems of the region, which is why Botswana and the Democratic Republic of Congo should, in the context of the regional economic and other structures to which they both belong, redouble their efforts to finding a lasting solution to the security challenges in the Eastern DRC.
Nairobi-based political commentator Wene Owino says President Tshisekedi's concerns over the conduct of the East African Regional Force are valid.
Tshisekedi is right. That's why the coming in of SADC forces might be seen as neutral, because of the historical bad blood between some of these militaries and the DRC. You remember, Uganda and Rwanda were very much involved when President Kabila rode to power in the DRC in the 90s. So these troops have been compromised all along. So Tshisekedi is right to do that, but whether the coming of SADC will bring lasting peace in DRC is another issue. It's a more complex issue than just neutral troops.
Fierce fighting has raged on for years in the North Kivu province of DRC, with more than 100 armed groups battling for valuable mineral resources. Attempts by VOA to get a comment from the Eastern African Community forces were not successful. Mkondisi Dube for VOA News, Gaborone, Botswana.
Scores of journalists in Cameroon's troubled northwest region have protested after rebels claimed responsibility for killing their colleague. A separatist spokesman acknowledged their forces shot the newspaper reporter Sunday night, but said they mistook him for a military officer. Moki Edwin Kinzeka has this report from Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Journalists in Cameroon's northwest region say they staged a peaceful march on the streets of the regional capital Bamenda on Tuesday to condemn the killing of their colleague, Anyende So. The Cameroon Association of English-Speaking Journalists, CAMASERJ, reports that armed men opened fire on So on Sunday night as he relaxed at a bar in the Tariko neighborhood of Bamenda. He was struck in the chest and died while being rushed to a hospital. CAMASERJ says it was a targeted killing because the armed men went straight to So and shot him in front of helpless onlookers. Jude Muma, local president of CAMASERJ, says journalists want the killers of So punished.
Some faction in the fighting in the northwest here have come out to take responsibility of what happened. We are saying that justice should take its course. Whoever pulled the trigger should pay for this crime. Human lives matter.
Muma spoke via a messaging app from Bamenda. The protest took place after separatists claimed responsibility for Nso's killing. Capo Daniel is the president of the Ambazonia People's Rights Advocacy Group. Daniel says the group commands separatists fighting to carve out an independent English-speaking state called Ambazonia from French-speaking majority Cameroon. Daniel says Nso was the victim of a case of mistaken identity. He spoke via a messaging app.
The Cameroon commanding officer who visits that particular bar was the target of the operation that was carried out by Ambazonian forces. Unfortunately, so the young journalist was killed by Ambazonian forces in a mistaken identity situation.
Daniel said the armed man who killed Nso has apologized, but journalists say the killer should be found and punished. Nso is not the only journalist who has died in the restive western regions. Samuel Wazizi, who worked for Chilean Music Television, was arrested in 2019 for allegedly supporting Anglophone separatists. He was not seen in public for more than a year. In 2020, the military declared that he died in government custody in August 2019. Cameroon journalists also say that reporters Thomas Awa Jr., T. Conrad, Macho Bibixi, and Kingsley Njoka are being held at the Yaoundé Kondinge prison. The reporters were accused of collaborating with Western separatists, but they say they were simply doing their jobs. The government has charged them with threatening Cameroon's national sovereignty. Richande Lajong is a publisher and editor of the Herald Tribune newspaper. He says Cameroonian journalists in the northwest and southwest regions are increasingly facing oppression, threats, attacks, and illegal detentions.
No matter how objective you are in your report, you'll be accused by the non-state armed groups of supporting the regular forces, or the regular forces will accuse you of reporting in favor of the non-state armed groups. Government or whoever is concerned should find a solution to this problem so that journalists can do their work with ease.
Mo Emile Simon, the Cameroon government's highest official in Meza municipality, where Bamenda is located, said government troops will hunt down the killers of So. The government says media in the northwest region will be protected and allowed free access to information, but asks reporters to be cautious as any other civilian. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
South Africa could be without electricity for up to 16 hours a day this winter as power infrastructure continues to erode and new green energy projects stall. Since last July, Africa's most industrialized economy has been without electricity for up to 11.5 hours a day. Energy experts blame decades of corruption and mismanagement at national energy company Eskom by successive African National Congress administrations. Darren Taylor has that report.
Winter's setting in, so people are using more electricity. But with an economy driven by energy-intensive industries such as mining, South Africa's old coal-driven power plants keep breaking down. Power company Eskom then implements what citizens have come to dread, load shedding, to ration power. The company uses stages numbered 1 to 8 for load shedding. The higher the stage, the longer the electricity outage. Under stage 8 load shedding, South Africa would effectively be left without electricity for 3.5 days a week. Now the government says an escalation to stage 9 will be necessary to prevent complete grid collapse this winter. This will mean South Africa won't have electricity for periods amounting to 4.5 days weekly. Bongani Mtetwa owns a small fuel station in Johannesburg. When there's no electricity, his pumps don't work and he can't sell petrol.
The economy is suffering. Our leaders, our presidents, our ministers, our cabinet, all of them are living a fancy life. They're doing the generators of which you can't afford. You can't afford solar systems, you can't afford anything.
He says stage 9 power cuts will destroy him. Parts of cities are sometimes without electricity for weeks on end as maintenance crews battle to clear backlogs of repair work. Johannesburg resident Jennifer Green calls this a catastrophe that's literally taken South Africa back to the dark ages.
Most of the time I don't have internet. By the time I do have internet, which is maybe 4 hours through the night, I don't work through the night. You're buying supplies because you can't store your meat and whatever. Everything's going to ruin. The amount of waste is diabolical. There's no electricity to pump the water that we need.
In the suburb of Greenside, Denise Govender says the government cannot be trusted to give people the services they pay for.
When load shedding ends, we basically don't have power coming back on. Our substations trip. I, for one, have a special needs son. And when there's medication that's needed, if things need to happen and our batteries are running out, there's nothing we can do. Then you've got to scramble around trying to get decent care.
Professor Hartmut Winkler, a physicist and energy analyst at the University of Johannesburg, says he's not shocked that the government's planning stage 9 power outages. He says the government's been announcing complex, unworkable plans to generate electricity for 15 years while failing to deal with the problems in the national power company. One of those problems, he says, is corruption that has siphoned off coal and machinery. Winkler says the crisis should have been avoided.
Things just haven't progressed nearly as fast as they should have. For example, the rollout of solar and wind power plants are roughly 2 years behind schedule, simply because the process was started late.
Business groups say electricity outages lasting more than half a day will result in unimaginable job losses and the economy will lose trillions of dollars. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
As South Africa's electricity problems deepen, power cuts have left most traffic lights dark, with frustrated motorists stuck in long traffic jams. Homeless and unemployed people have taken over almost all major road intersections in Johannesburg, where they control traffic for a few coins in return. Tuso Kumalo has more from Johannesburg.
The impact of increasing power cuts in South Africa deepens each day. The blackouts have rendered traffic lights useless, causing chaos on the roads, especially mornings and evenings. Homeless and unemployed people have stepped in to help control traffic at busy intersections. Dobeko Bangada is among the many living on the streets of Johannesburg. He decided to control traffic at a busy intersection near the suburb of Sandton because drivers are grateful.
I'm looking something to eat. Yeah. Sometimes I give me something, even just 2 rand, 5 rand. I'm going looking for a job somewhere. If I didn't find a job, I coming just asking the money. Everything they can do for me.
South Africa's unemployment rate tops 33%. 33-year-old Johnson Molaise lost his job in 2019. When the power cuts heightened, the father of three decided to help motorists at a busy traffic light in Rand Park Ridge in Johannesburg. In return, he says, drivers leave him a little cash and goodies.
You know the pain that one goes through when you've got nothing to put on the table or to feed your family. And, you know, you need to go out there trying to help the people, you know, try to ease the frustration, the stress and all that. But it's not much, at least when the sunset, you've got something, bread, you know, times are tough.
Musa Serokwe is one of many motorists who are grateful to Malaise and his colleagues at the lights.
These people have decided to stand up for the nation. They are really helping us. We really appreciate the good job that they are doing to us. They really deserve something. Can the government at least realize what they are doing?
Authorities, however, are not impressed. Johannesburg Metro Police spokesperson Tolani Fitler told journalists the unauthorized traffic controllers are not welcome as they endanger their own lives and those of motorists.
It is commendable to a certain point, but we do know that if an accident does happen whilst they are controlling traffic, then the city won't be liable and it will be at the cost of the motorists. So it is important that if you do come across that type of situation as a motorist, please do call the Johannesburg Metropolitan Police Department, and officers are sent to remove those people and to help alleviate congestion if there is congestion.
But the traffic controllers say as long as the government does not bring a solution to both the unemployment and electricity crisis, they will continue helping motorists even if it means they might be arrested. Reporting for VOA News in Johannesburg, I am Tuso Kumalo.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. A member of Tunisia's security services opened fire on Jewish pilgrims and fellow officers at the festival of Lag BaOmer on the island of Djerba, killing 5 people and wounding several others before police fatally shot him. Reporter Alicia Volkman has more from Tunis.
The sound of gunshots and the cries of visitors brought the festivities of the Jewish festival of Lag BaOmer to a sudden and tragic end on the island of Djerba, home to one of the oldest Jewish settlements outside of Israel. El Griba, Africa's oldest synagogue, has suffered previous terrorist attacks and is always under heavy armed guard. However, this hasn't discouraged Jewish pilgrims and tourists from all over the world from participating in the lively pilgrimage processions that have continued for over 2,500 years. Muslims as well as Jews visit the synagogue to light candles and write their wishes on eggs laid out there, hoping that God grants their dreams. Only this time it was their worst nightmares that came true. We were just 100 meters away from the shooting when it happened. At first we didn't know what was happening and thought maybe it was just children playing with toy guns. We were inside the tour bus in the parking lot outside El Griba Synagogue, and we had to stay inside the bus for about an hour before we could safely go outside. That was Professor Emeritus Habib Kazdahli, a scholar of Jewish history and culture who formerly taught at Manuba University in Tunis. Each year he organises a trip of some 20 students studying Tunisian Jewish history for seminars and to follow the festival. The Tunisian Ministry of Interior issued a statement on the incident. They said the attacker cut his colleague's throat before seizing weapons and ammunition and heading towards the synagogue, where he opened fire indiscriminately on security units stationed there. Police returned fire, shooting him dead, but not before the shooter had killed 2 pilgrims identified as Benjamin Hadath, a French Tunisian, and also Aviel Hadath, an Israeli Tunisian. 4 other civilians were injured and taken to a hospital for treatment. 6 security agents were injured, 1 in a critical condition, and two officers were killed. The Ministry of the Interior says an investigation is underway to discover the shooter's motivation, so it hasn't been labelled as a terrorist attack. Professor Kazdakhli said the attack left survivors stunned and barely able to speak a word. We don't know what this means for Tunisia, but we are holding another seminar in the coming days, and scholars are joining us in solidarity against this attack. Many visitors scrambled to get early flights home amid scenes that one witness described as chaos. Normally, Lag Boma is a joyful occasion and is seen as a symbol of Tunisia's famed religious tolerance. Following a rise of racial violence in Tunisia, concerns are being raised about a rise of anti-Jewish intolerance. For Voice of America Africa, I'm Elizia Folkman in Tunis, Tunisia.
Health agencies warn that viral hepatitis could kill more people by the year 2040 than HIV, tuberculosis, and malaria combined if it remains a neglected and underfunded disease. Lisa Schlein has the details for VOA from Geneva.
The World Health Organization reports every year viral hepatitis, a potentially life-threatening liver infection, affects more than 350 million people globally and kills more than a million. It says the African region accounts for 26% of the global burden for hepatitis B and C, including 125,000 deaths. Kenneth Kabagambe, who contracted hepatitis B in 2012, founded the National Organization for People Living with Hepatitis B in Uganda. He says the organization aims to raise awareness of the disease and shatter the myths that stigmatize victims and discourage them from seeking help.
For example, there are issues to do with the myths and misconceptions, which actually are drawn from the lack of clear information about the transmission of hepatitis B and hepatitis C in the communities. These actually have led to domestic violences in some families because people think that hepatitis B is just casually transmitted, which is not correct.
Hepatitis B is spread through sexual transmission and through contact with the blood, open sores, or body fluids from a person infected with the disease. However, the main mode of transmission is from mother to child during birth and delivery. WHO reports around 70% of hepatitis B infections worldwide occur in Africa, and 70% of those infected with the disease are children younger than five. Senior Director of the Viral Hepatitis Global Program at the Clinton Health Access Initiative, Auriel Fernandez, is based in Rwanda. She says the best way to prevent hepatitis B is by getting vaccinated. Unfortunately, she says, the first birth dose of this vaccine has very low coverage in Africa.
In the Africa region, in 2021, only 17% of newborn babies in the WHO Africa region received a timely hepatitis B birth dose. And only 14 of the countries in the region have policies for routine Hep B birth dose vaccinations.
She says effective and affordable treatments are available for hepatitis B and hepatitis C, which is largely spread through unsafe drug injections. However, she adds poor countries need financial help to get these programs moving. Next week, the Hepatitis Fund and the Clinton Health Access Initiative is holding a high-level pledging conference, the first ever, in Geneva to address this issue and spur along the global elimination campaign. The conference hopes to raise $150 million. However, organizers note it will take between $7 and $8 billion to eliminate viral hepatitis by 2030. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that wraps it up for this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mukbil Yaburo, and our engineer, Najwan Kali, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
The
this week. Shaky ceasefires and clashes in Sudan. Citizens fleeing the capital.